Please join me in the book of Job, chapter 39, verse 1 is where we're going to start in just a moment. We have come to what I think is the most important part of the book, and that is the words of God. Job has been asking, nay, demanding that God come down and present himself to Job for deposition, to allow Job to query him, question him on why all this stuff has been happening to him when he hasn't done anything wrong. Well, God's arrived. And instead of just letting Job start quiz him, God starts quizzing Job. God is treating Job like a beloved younger son who has demanded that dad explain everything to him as to why certain things happen in his life. And so dad has instead said, well, son, let me see what you already know and understand, and then we'll go from there. How about? And so God starts asking Job, do you understand creation? Were you there when it happened? No? How about weather? Do you understand how weather works? Do you understand where dark and light is when they're not, you know, currently being used? Do you understand where rain and snow and frost and hail are when they're not being used? Do you understand any of that? No? And so now God has switched over to the animal world. And so at the end of chapter 38, he had asked Job, do you help the lions hunt? Do you make sure they get fed and not starve to death? Do you do that? No? Maybe you help with the ravens, make sure that they get food? Perhaps that's what you've been taking care of? No? And so God sticks on that line of encouraging Job to come to the conclusion he is not quite at the level of understanding that he thought he might be. So chapter 39, verse 1. Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the does? Can you number the months that they fulfill? And do you know the time when they give birth, when they crouch, bring forth their offspring, and are delivered of their young? Their young ones become strong, and they grow up in the open. They go out, and they don't return to them. So, hey, Job, what about the wild mountain goats? You know, not the domestic ones where you guys have a good grasp on, you know, oh, I know exactly what day this one got pregnant, and because I was there when it happened, and so I've got a very good handle on when we can expect the babies to arrive. Not that bunch, the wild ones. Do you have a concept of how all that works? And while you're at it, Job, do you understand how they even survive without humans helping? You know, they have babies, and then the babies are like almost instantly hopping around on the little cliff sides, taking care of themselves, and pretty soon they're not even around mom and dad anymore. So, good illustration of how the wild, God set it up where it takes care of itself. It doesn't need humans understanding how the process works. Verse 5, or who has let the wild donkey go free? Who's loosed the bonds of the swift donkey to whom I have given the arid plain for his home and the salt land for his dwelling place? Now, the arid plain, that's just dry areas, but the salt land, that sounds a little bit like the region right around the Dead Sea, or the former site of Sodom and Gomorrah and the other cities of the plain that got blasted out of existence back in the time of Abraham. And so, again, this is a region not very far from where we think Uz must be. And so Job seems to be familiar with wild donkeys that range all over that region. Not the domesticated ones, the wild ones. So God says he scorns the tumult of the city. So he's not one of those donkeys you see when you go to town. He hears not the shouts of the driver, so no human controls his life. He ranges the mountains as his pasture, and he searches after every green thing. So the question for Job is basically, do you understand the life of a wild donkey? No? How about this one, verse 9? Is the wild ox willing to serve you? Now, they've got domesticated oxen, but God says, I don't want to talk about them. Those are definitely within your frame of reference. But what about that wild one out there? Will he spend the night at your manger? I mean, can you entice him to come over to your place and eat in your barn? Can you bind him in the furrow with ropes, or will he harrow the valleys after you? So, do you honestly think you can harness that wild ox and make him help you in your agriculture pursuits? Do you really think you can do that? Will you depend on him because his strength is great, or will you leave to him your labor? So will you trust him, you know, to use his strength on your behalf? Do you have faith in him that he will return your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? Now again, these are all rhetorical. There is no way in the world any person with sense would think they could take a wild animal and benefit by using them as if they were a domesticated animal. You would spend more time fighting with the animal, and you'd be lucky if it didn't kill you trying to escape back to the wild. It wouldn't be worth your time. And so Job is supposed to accept from this the reality that he doesn't know all that much about how the world works. He's only got a small frame of reference. Verse number 13, the wings of the ostrich wave proudly. And not 100% certain that this is the ostrich that we know. It might be, but it could be another animal that's being referenced, another bird animal that does some of the same sorts of things. But the point is easily understood. The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are they the pinions and plumage of love? Meaning, she'd love to come and work for you? For she leaves her eggs in the earth and lets them be warmed on the ground, forgetting that a foot may crush them and that the wild beast may trample them. So basically, this creature, possibly an ostrich, I forgot I was going to go back and check this again before I came here today, as to whether or not ostriches are more considerate of their chicks than what we see here in the passage. We do know that there are some animals, birds, that don't care about their offspring whatsoever. But anyway, the point here is she doesn't seem to care too much about whether her babies make it or not. Verse 16, she deals cruelly with her young as if they were not hers. Though her labor be in vain, yet she has no fear, because God has made her forget wisdom and given her no share in understanding. So basically, God didn't give her the sense to understand that she should be taking care of her babies. But when she rouses herself to flee, she laughs at the horse and his rider. So this, whatever bird this is, can really move, which is why I think some people think it ostrich makes the best sense. So even though she's not smart enough or sensible enough to take care of her own chicks, she is pretty all gone fast. And so, Job, do you understand how that works? And of course, Job would have said, no, that doesn't click with me. Since God was talking about horses, that's where he goes next. Do you give the horse his might? Do you clothe his neck with a mane? Do you make him leap like the locust? His majestic snorting is terrifying. He paws in the valley and exults in his strength, and he goes out to meet the weapons. Now, the horse that he's talking about is a domesticated horse, but it is not the civilian domesticated horse. This is the war horse. And so a war horse is specially trained to be fearless and even aggressive when in battle. And so God says he laughs at fear and is not dismayed. He doesn't turn back from the sword. Upon him rattle the quiver, the flashing spear, and the javelin. So he's all decked out with his rider's equipment. With fierceness and rage, he swallows the ground. So he's fast. He cannot still stand still at the sound of the trumpet. So he's always excited before he goes into battle. When the trumpet sounds, he says, "Aha!" He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of the captains, and the shouting. So God is questioning Job. So do you understand war horses? Do you understand the mindset of war horses? And it is highly unlikely that he did. Verse 26, "Is it by your understanding that the hawk soars and spreads his wings toward the south?" So now we turn from the animals on the ground to the animals in the sky, which is all pretty amazing as well. So, Job, do you understand how that hawk just kind of goes round and round and round and round up there, just soars around? And all of us, I think, have seen this and thought about it. You know, wow, it doesn't even flap its wings. It just soars. It just stays up there. That's amazing. "Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and makes his nest on high?" So there are the eagles way up there on the cliff faces. "On the rock he dwells and makes his home, on the rocky crag and stronghold. From there he spies out the prey. His eyes behold it from afar." And we actually know this, that some of these predatory birds have exceptionally precise binocular vision. They can see things a long ways away and then come diving down and hitting that prey precisely. Verse 30, "His young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there he is." The eagles that they typically thought of were the brown or golden eagles, which did engage in scavenger behavior. So they would show up after battles and pick at the dead bodies. And so that gets mentioned here. Now, the unspoken question for Job is, so Job, do you understand how all that works? Do you understand how birds can fly? And, of course, Job doesn't. Chapter 40. "He who is," said to Job, "shall the fault finder contend with the Almighty?" Now, I'm a little bit uncomfortable with the English Standard Version translators choosing the English word fault finder at this point. I think I would have gone with more something like the inquisitor, the interrogator, because it seems to be going along with this idea that Job had said, if only God would come down here and let me ask him questions. And so it's not that, I don't think it's so much that Job is accusing God of doing wrong. Now, his companions seem to have agreed that Job was doing that, but it seems more likely to me that Job the whole time was saying, I haven't done anything wrong to deserve being punished. So what I really would like is for God to come and explain me why these bad things are happening to me. So it's not that he was accusing God of doing wrong to him. He is wanting to demand that God explain it. And so that's why I'd probably go with interrogator. And the word contend, you see the word contend there, is the Hebrew word for bringing a lawsuit. And so that goes along with the sense that Job wanted to depose God. He wanted to bring him into a court of law and have him explain things. So God says, shall the interrogator contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, and that's argue in the sense of a court setting, meaning explain why you did this. He who argues with God, let him answer it. Go ahead, Job. I asked you questions. I decided to start by asking you what you already know. Get kind of a baseline of just how smart you are before I let you ask me questions. And so as soon as God says those, Job speaks up again. It's the first time we've heard from Job since before Elihu started pounding on him. And so this is the first time that Job is able to respond to God appearing to him. Verse 3, then Job answered he who is and said, behold, I am of small account. So I am nobody compared to you. What shall I answer you? I can't. I can't answer any of these questions you just asked me. I lay my hand on my mouth. You know, it's that southern that southern expression, shut my mouth, right? I lay my hand on my mouth. I've spoken once, but I'm not going to try to answer. Twice, I'm not going to proceed any further. All right, so Job's response to God is, no, sir, I have nothing to say in response to what you've just quizzed me about. I don't know any of those things. Verse 6, then he who is answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, so now we have a second time here in chapter 40 that God is cited as being in this windstorm. In last session, I said that I believe this is probably that supernatural glowing cloud of God's presence with the cherubim at the base, the seraphim above his throne, and his throne prominently displayed inside of this this phenomena. And so it would be a very impressive and awe-inspiring vision. And so God speaks to him again out of this. And he says, dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you make it known to me. So the quizzing of Job continues. Will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be in the right? So now God says, all right, Job, would you want to say that I have done something wrong? Would you like to make that accusation? Just so that you will feel that you're right in saying that none of this stuff happened to you in a fair way. It had nothing to do with any sin of yours. Would you like to make that accusation? Have you an arm like God? Can you thunder with a voice like his? So it's a challenge for Job to go ahead and make an accusation against God if that's what he would like to do. Now, of course, there is no way in the world righteous Job is going to do that. But God needs to highlight that there is no basis for Job doing such a thing. Verse 10, adorn yourself with majesty and dignity. Clothe yourself with glory and splendor. The wording here seems to be an invitation. Why don't you dress yourself up like I dress myself up? Go ahead. Make yourself just as majestic and glorious as I am. Pour out the overflowing of your anger and look on everyone who is proud and abase him. So, Job, are you God? Can you dress up like God? Can you take on the role of God? Look on everyone who is proud and bring him low and tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them all in the dust together. Bind their faces in the world below, meaning execute them from this life and put their dead bodies in the ground and their living souls in the waiting place. Verse 14, then will I also acknowledge to you that your own right hand can save you. So Job, then and only then will I acknowledge that you have a case for putting me in deposition mode. If you know what God knows, then yeah, I'd answer your questions. But the fact of the matter is that Job is not God. Job is a man, and as a man, he is extremely limited in his information. He doesn't know anything about chapters 1 and 2. So he's not even aware of the extenuating circumstances that brought all this stuff about. So God's not done, and thankfully for us, he's not, because God now goes into the description of two animals that are fascinating to read about. Verse number 15, behold Behemoth. Now that's Hebrew, and it's basically the idea of four-footed thing. The English Standard Version throws a nice footnote in at this point saying, a large animal, exact identity unknown. Great. I think that's much better than what I think the New American Standard did at this point, where they suggested an animal. Let me see. Hold on. Let me jump over to that point in my New American Standard. Yep. In Job 40:15, the footnote says, or the hippopotamus. Now, there is a huge problem with that. In the Greek Old Testament, which was translated in the 3rd century BC, the people doing the translating were Hebrew-Greek speakers. They were bilingual. They knew both languages. They thought and spoke and wrote in both languages. And so at this point in the Greek Old Testament, it doesn't use the Greek word hippopotamus, because that is a Greek word. It means water horse. They chose to use a word that means big animal. That's it. Animal. And so even the Jewish people in the 3rd century BC did not fully understand what this animal was. I will suggest to you in a few minutes what classification I think it falls into. So behold Behemoth, which I made as I made you. So he's a creature of God. He eats grass like an ox. So he's an herbivore. Behold his strength in his loins and his power in the muscles of his belly. So there's great big muscles in his belly and chest area. He makes his tail stiff like a cedar. Actually, I think the wording is more along the lines of his tail is a cedar. Now, when they talked about cedar trees, they were thinking about the cedars of Lebanon. And if you think about the cedars of Lebanon, you should think of probably a smaller version of our redwoods, our sequoias. So great big monster trees. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze, his limbs like bars of iron, meaning they are very strong. Now, if you didn't get the impression yet, the next verse removes all doubt that this is an amazing creature. He is the first of the works of God. So he is the number one animal, land animal, apparently, that existed in the time of Job. He was nothing to be thought of as trivial. The next line says, let him who made him bring near his sword, giving the impression that basically only God can take this critter down. Well, we're almost out of time, so I'm not going to tease you any longer. We'll come back and finish this next time. But I believe, like others do, that this is likely a description of one of the large, four-legged, now extinct dinosaurs. I mean, the really monstrous ones. And that at this time, there was at least a few of them still left in the Jordan Valley area.